The following Women's Spaces show was recorded on Monday, June 24th, 2019.
The woman in your life will do what she must do to comfort you and calm you down and let you rest now. The woman in your life, she can rest so easily. She does everything you do because the woman in your life is you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Women's Spaces. My name is Elaine B. Holtz, and I'm your host. And with me at the board is my best friend, my partner, my engineer, and my co-producer, Ken Norton. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning.
Oh, it's been a wonderful day here in Sonoma County. I mean, it's just the weather's beautiful, and we are alive and well. Who could ask for anything more? Well, we have a very interesting show today. Joining me in the studio is Cynthia Lewin, the Visitor Services and Volunteer Coordinator for the Museum of Sonoma County, and Sarah Schrader, who is the chair for the American for Safe Access here in Sonoma County, and we'll be talking about the history of cannabis and a special historical presentation of the history of cannabis at the Museum of Sonoma County that is happening now. In fact, it's happening from this point to September 15th, so folks really want to get out there and see it. But we'll have a conversation, and then we'll be able to tell you everywhere that you need to go and how you can see this. Also joining me in the studio is Shelley Browning from Friends of Public Banking, and we're going to talk about public banking, and hopefully folks listening will get an understanding about what that is all about. And all I can say when it comes to public banking, the times, they are a-changing. We're looking at all kinds of new things as how we can improve our economy and improve our ways of living together on this planet. Anyway, as you know, our history is our strength. And in 2020, can you believe this, folks? In 2020, it will be 100 years anniversary since we got the right to vote, since women got the right to vote. And I really want to encourage my listeners out there to try to get a hold of the film Iron-Jawed Angels. It's with Hilary Swank. That really gives you some information and background about what happened with the suffrage movement from 1916 to 1920 till we finally got the vote. And I'm going to tell you a little secret. These guys did not want us to vote. We only got the vote by one vote. And that was because when you watch the movie, a mother wrote her son and said, "You better vote yes on this or don't come home." That's what it took for us to get the vote. And here, look at us today, 2019. We're about to lose so many of our rights, and we have to stand up. But we have to understand our history. We have to understand where we have come from. You know, it's really interesting. I graduated Sonoma State. And this was, I went to Sonoma State in 1973 to 1975. And it was so interesting. I think it was my second or third semester there, and I was very involved in women's studies. We got a telegram that some women, young girls, were trying to play soccer. And they couldn't do it because women were not allowed on the field to play these kind of games, especially in competitive sports. So what happened was there was a big uproar about that. And what happened was is that we actually changed the rules, and that was through Title IX, which made it possible for women to compete on the athletic field, which is very interesting. I mean, I'm not a supporter, really, to be honest with you, of a woman playing football. I mean, that's my own bias. But I support that woman if she wants to go out and play football. That's her right. Or baseball, or soccer, or any of the other of the competitive games. And let me give you a little example. In fact, in June 23rd, 1972, so today's the 24th, so yesterday was an anniversary, Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972 was signed by President Nixon, one of the most important legislative initiatives passed for women and girls since women won the vote in 1920. This legislation guarantees equal access and equal opportunity for female and male students in almost all aspects of our educational system. Very important. And it was a struggle. Like everything else is a struggle for women to get their needs met or their name known. Another thing that happened, and that would be tomorrow, another anniversary, is June 25th, 1903. Marie Curie defends her doctoral thesis on radioactive substances at the Université de la Sorbonne in Paris, becoming the first woman in France to receive a doctoral degree. 1903, up to that point, there was not a woman that had a doctoral degree. Today, I must have at least 10 friends who have doctor's degrees. So we have come a long way. Okay, a special announcement. I want to do a shout-out for a dear friend of mine, Marty Bennett. And Marty Bennett does North Bay Jobs with Justice. He's retiring, and they're going to be having a big party for him this Saturday, June 29th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Petaluma Veterans Building at 1094 Petaluma Boulevard in Petaluma. You know, the North Bay Jobs with Justice is just an amazing organization. It's a nonprofit coalition of labor unions and community faith-based environmental and student organizations. Wow. Working to promote workers' rights and economic and social justice. The organization provides a space for open dialogue and collaboration between labor unions and community organizations. My father was a union man. This is very dear to my heart. So thank you so much, Marty Bennett. We're going to miss you, but, you know, we know you'll be around, and you have definitely made your impact. Wow, a lot going on in our community. You know, it's really amazing when you think about all the things that people are doing. In fact, one of the things that I'm trying to focus on is all the positive things, all the wonderful things that people are doing, rather than all the garbage that we hear. Oh, this isn't happening. Oh, and look at right now, we're looking at maybe going to war. Makes no sense, folks. But we have to stand up and we have to join one another and say, enough is enough. Anyway, that's a lot to think about, a lot to think about. And I, you know, one of the things that happens to me, I think I'm thinking too much, but you know how it is. Okay, so I can't believe it. It's June 24th. It's the last Monday of the month. And listen, I need to tell my listeners, on July 1st, Ken and I will be in Yosemite. So we're not going to be having a show. We're going to take a little bit of a vacation, but we will be on the following week. So just to let folks know. Well, it's the last month, a Monday of the month, and we're going to do the Women's Spaces Pledge. You know, two things happen. One, I got an email, and the question they asked me is, why do I call myself Elaine B? Well, it's a good question. Well, I'll tell you why. My middle name actually is Beverly, you know, but I'm a public speaker, and I go out, and you know, when you have to go out in front of a group and speak, it is very nerve-wracking. You know, you feel the adrenaline running up and down your body, and you say, oh, calm down, calm down. Well, what I did is I took my initial B, and I call myself Elaine B, and I introduce myself, and it reminds me I'm doing the best I can. I'm a beautiful child of the universe, and to be here now. And I'm also a beekeeper. We just had two swarms come in, so that's also for the bee. So Elaine B. Holtz is really a way for me to remind myself that I'm okay, and it's okay that I am presenting. You know, and I love it when I say I'm a beautiful child of the universe. You know, we're all beautiful children of the universe. You know, and we all have to look at that and really feel that inside ourselves. You know, and one of the things that I used to do when I gave seminars is I would have people take your middle initial and give yourself a characterization. Like, you're beautiful, you're, you know, sometimes even the B stands for I'm being very boastful, because sometimes I get out there and I can be very brash, and that's all okay. All those things are okay. So try it sometime. So let's go ahead and do the pledge. I see Ken has it on the screen here. It's such a beautiful pledge. You know, just a little background. I wrote it for my grandson, Ryan, when he was about 5 or 6 years old, when he came out of the nursery and said, he was crying. I says, Ryan, why are you crying? He says, because my teacher called me a bad boy. I says, you're not a bad boy, and your self-esteem does not depend on her. And that's when we made up this little mantra. And I did it for him for years. And when he graduated Santa Cruz, University, he's coming down the hill, and he recited that to his grandmother, which made me feel really good. And so we decided, Ken and I decided, we needed something to kind of identify women's spaces with, and that's what the pledge is all about. So I have three people, and plus Ken. Oh my goodness, we have a wonderful crowd here. If you would please join me. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to say the first line and then just repeat after me, and then we'll all do it together without me, you know, having you repeat after me. So here we go. The Women's Spaces Pledge. My self-esteem,
does not depend on anything outside of me.
My self-esteem depends on my relationship with myself and my higher power. Ooh, it just gives me the chills. By the way, I read that 5 times before I come on the air to remind me that, hey, my self-esteem does not depend on anything outside of me. It depends on my relationship with myself and my higher power. And now we're going to say it. Let's all just say it together one time with lots of feeling. Oh, this is so exciting having you wonderful women in the audience. I love doing this show. You know, this is, I believe, my contribution to the community. And I hope all you folks out there are enjoying it. And if you go on www.womenspaces.com, you can make a copy of the pledge, or you can email me at elaine@womenspaces.com, and I will be very happy to send you a little sticker. Anyway, let's go 1, 2, 3 together. My self-esteem does not depend on anything outside of me. My self-esteem depends on my relationship with myself and my higher power. Oh God, that sounds great. Thank you so much for joining me. And today, folks, is a very special day. In fact, it's very unusual. You know, if I'm able to do a show, say, on my birthday, say, on Ken's birthday, or anybody, a friend's birthday, whatever's going on. But this day is very special. On June 24th, 1939, my mother and father, Betty and Sol Holtz, were married. And my father, every year on their anniversary, they would play this song, the anniversary song. And it was sung at that time by Al Jolson. But since this is a woman's show, I went looking to see if I could find a woman that sings this song. And I found one of my favorite artists from way back when. I mean, when I say this name, I doubt if many people are going to know who it is. It's Dinah Shore. She is singing the anniversary song. So I want to play that for everybody. I want to wish anybody out there that's having an anniversary to kind of listen to this song. And when I listen to it, I can see my father on the June the 24th, it'd be about 11 or 12 o'clock, you know, we just had breakfast or did some sort of celebration, and he would put this song on and he would dance with my mother. And it was just so beautiful to see. And so I thought that I would honor them and play it. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to listen to the anniversary song. Like I said, it was originally sung by Al Jolson, which is way back when, but we're going to listen to the song sung by Dinah Shore. And, you know, I'd like to just say that, again, happy, happy anniversary. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with, you know, I'm really, Cynthia, can you pronounce your last name for me to make sure I have it?
Law.
So we're going to talk to Cynthia Law, who's from the Sonoma County, from the Museum of Sonoma County. She's the Visitor Services and Volunteer Coordinator. And joining her is Sarah Schrader, who is the Chair for American for Safe Access here in Sonoma County. So here we go with the anniversary song sung by Dinah Shore.
Oh, how we danced on the night we were wed. We vowed our true love, though a word wasn't said. The world was in blue, there were stars in the sky, except for the few that were there in your eyes. Tears, I held you so close in charms to hearts gently beating were murmuring low, my darling, I love you so. To fade into blossoming dawn, the sun shone anew, but the dance lingered on. Could we but relive that sweet moment sublime, we'd time. Dears, I held you so close in my arms. Angels were singing a hymn to your charms. Two hearts gently beating were murmuring low. My darling, I love you so.
What a beautiful memory that is. And I hope you all enjoyed that song. I sure did. I can't believe, even after all these years, and I figured it out, my folks would have been married had they lived to enjoy it, would have been married 70 years. It's just amazing. Time goes by so quickly. Anyway, for you just joining us, you are listening to KBBF 89.1 FM, Calistoga, Santa Rosa. And I want to remind my listeners that the opinions expressed here are not necessarily the opinions of KBBF, its board of directors, its members, or Women's Spaces. Well, welcome back. You're listening to Women's Spaces, and I'm your host, Elaine B. Holtz. And without further ado, I want to introduce my two wonderful guests here. Joining me in the studio are Cynthia Lang, who I made a mistake. What she actually does is she's the Director of Public Programs and Tours for the Museum of Sonoma County. And also joining us is Sarah Schrader, who is the Chair of Americans for Safe Access here in Sonoma County. Well, welcome, ladies. Welcome to Women's Spaces.
Good morning.
Good morning, Elaine.
Well, let's start out with you, Sarah. You know, I have a bio on Cynthia, but I don't have a bio on you. So tell us just a little bit about you, and tell us a little bit about Americans for Safe Access and how you got involved with the cannabis exhibit that's going on at the Museum of Sonoma County.
Thank you for having me here this morning. As an advocate and educator for medical cannabis here in Sonoma for over a decade, I have been working on changing policy and helping educate patients and caregivers to comply with California law. And it excited me to be able to bring some of our history to life and be able to share the stories behind the pioneers that helped change the laws here locally. So I was introduced to the museum's curator, Eric, through Brian Applegarth from California Tourism Association. And I have been very excited to be a part of this project and help collect some of the artifacts that were presented in the display.
Well, what's it, you know, we're going to talk about the display, but while you just mentioned the artifact, what's one of your favorite ones? I mean, Ken and I had a wonderful tour, and it was amazing, you know, especially to see the zigzag picture. I love that someone actually did a big picture. And there's a little bit more pride in cannabis rather than looking at it as this evil weed, if you know what I'm saying. What was your favorite artifact, Sarah?
I think my favorite part of the exhibit was showing the medical value of this plant prior to prohibition. You know, being able to see its medical use in a variety of different forms, and for people to understand that historically worldwide, this is something that has been used by many different countries for many different ailments.
Something like 10, maybe 50,000 years. I mean, they know they find cannabis. All of a sudden, it shows up somewhere.
Indeed.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And thank you for the work you've done over the year. I'm very familiar with Sarah's work, and she's really kind of, we've held it together, and I want to thank you so much for that. Well, here we go. We got Cynthia Long here with us, who's the Director of Public Programs and Tours. Welcome, Cynthia. Welcome to Women's Spaces. I think this is your second interview here, I believe.
Yes. Thank you, Elaine.
So I'd like to tell our listeners a little bit about you. Is that okay?
Sure.
Cynthia Long has worked at the Museum of Sonoma County since 2013. She has worked as a visitor services and volunteer coordinator and presently is now working as the museum's director of public programs and tours. Cynthia manages the educational arm of the museum, which includes our school and private adult tours, the museum outreach programs, including our Art for Kids program and the museum's public program. She also organizes the museum's annual Dia de los Muertos exhibit. That's a lot, Cynthia. Anything else you'd like to add, my friend?
Nope, that's pretty much sums it up. Thank you.
Well, Cynthia, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, I have Sarah here in the audience, who in the studio, who's been working around cannabis forever, and now here you are, you're working for the museum, doing this exhibit. What was it? Give us a little background about this, and what motivated you, and how did that fit in with, okay, your vision of what you're doing at the museum?
Well, this is the history arm of the museum. We are history and art, and it's been percolating for quite a few years, about 8 years. We've been thinking about doing this exhibit. It's of course, been a big question, you know, in terms of all the propositions that have come up, and this came up. And, of course, when Oakland Museum did their exhibit, we kind of started thinking, oh, well, somebody Elsa started, maybe we can start doing our exhibit. Oakland's museum's exhibit has a lot about the social, besides social policy, but also its social standing and how cannabis basically in society affects different groups of people. Ours actually took more of a historical look, and we start with as much as, you know, 12,000 years ago when cannabis sort of first started being a plant that people were cultivating that we know of. It probably started earlier than that. And it's one of the first cultivated plants that humans did. And it has two pathways, as hemp and also as for its tendency to give you a high. So it has two pathways in which it went. It traveled all over the world, and it actually came to California even with the missionaries. The Spaniards actually had subsidies to encourage people to grow the cannabis, and this was mainly for hemp.
Well, you know, I just want to inject something a little bit about the hemp. The hemp, the story is so interesting because during World War II, you know, we made rope and we did all mm-hmm. kinds of things with it. And I believe it was William Randolph Hearst who had a forest or had some trees or he owned something and all of a sudden wanted to turn it into paper. So he thought paper would be better to print papers than hemp. And so that's kind of how hemp got the bad name. And then with the marijuana, of course, it was with Richard Nixon putting it into Schedule I and making it one of the most harmful. I mean, I don't understand how it got there, mm-hmm. but it really does have a very, very interesting history. When you say 12,000 years,
right?
You know, I mean that's amazing.
So yeah, the museum's exhibit gives more of a historical perspective, but we're also not really taking one particular point of view. We're keeping it very even, and it's basically you're going to come in and learn a lot about hemp and cannabis and a lot about the plant, as well as you're going to learn a lot about the people behind it. And
well, you know, we went on tour, and I just want the folks to know, when you first walk in, the first thing you see is a map.
Yes.
The first thing, I mean, when I looked at that map, I could not believe the voyage that marijuana and cannabis, now as we call it, that cannabis made to come to the United States. It's just amazing.
Yes, so one of the things in the exhibit is that plants actually have an agenda, so to speak. I mean, a plant really wants to reproduce and go as far as possible. And that's exactly what marijuana has done. And we talk about co-evolution here between humans and cannabis. And this is maybe not something that people always think about, but it was certainly explored by Michael Pollan in his book, Botany of Desire.
What is that about?
Oh, that we have co-evolved, and that by having this ability to make us happy, that the plant encourages us to grow it and spread it all over the world, which is exactly what we've done.
Well, what's so interesting when you say that, you know, in my lifetime, you know, in being involved in understanding the plant itself, I get that feeling that somehow it's almost like, I mean, they call it Mary Jane. It's almost like a woman appealing to you, grow me, water me, take care of me. I mean, it's just amazing. Well, you know, working with the exhibit, what was some of your favorite things? One thing that I learned when, you know, I used to hear, oh, the Emerald Triangle, and there was a map right there showing me that here we are, Mendocino County, and up north there, that's the Emerald Triangle. So we, in this community here, Northern California, it's been around for a long time. What was your favorite piece that you saw, or what really excited you about the exhibit itself?
Well, I think the Emerald Triangle is really important to Sonoma County because we are actually the corridor from which all the marijuana then moves to San Francisco. And then, of course, the money goes the other way, to the Emerald Triangle from San Francisco. So we're actually the corridor. And so that makes, and then all the activity in terms of legalization has occurred mostly coming from Northern California.
Well, we're responsible, California. Huh? We're the bad guys. Are we the bad guys?
Well, you know. So that's really kind of fascinating. But anyway, you asked me about my favorite, and my favorite are actually the two plants we have.
Oh, okay, yeah, two plants growing there. What? Mm-hmm. Like I said, we've come a long way, baby.
Mm-hmm.
So you have two plants there, and
yes, they're actually they've got LED lights that are programmed and have AI apparently with their programming, and it has a special watering system that waters them. Based on moisture that's in the soil. So it actually tests the moisture before it waters them. And
be careful. They'll turn you into a grower. I mean, my goodness. You know, you start watching it evolve. You know, Cynthia, that's really interesting. You know, what was your background? I mean, how did you feel about cannabis before you even did the exhibit? And it has your mind changed, or has anything been enhanced? What was your thoughts?
Well, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and of course, that was a time period when everybody was scaring children with the idea that you are going to, it's going to cause erratic, strange behavior if you smoke it, and also that it's a gateway drug.
And, right, reefer madness.
Yes, and so I grew up with that, and I was unfortunate, a very goody-two-shoes, so I never actually tried it. I even got through 4 years of Berkeley without ever trying it, so I managed to actually get through life without actually having tried cannabis. But having done the exhibit, it's and that's where we hope other people will kind of look at it. It's like it really kind of opens your mind as to what it really is. So, I mean, you have to separate the facts from the rumors that go on about things. And also, it's fascinating, too, to see how the legislation has more to do with people's emotions than it really does with scientific basis. So
I
think that's really, I think that's something that everybody going to the exhibit, you should make up your own mind about it and look at it objectively.
Sarah, what's your thought now that it's completed? You went through it, you walked through it. Would you agree with Cynthia about what?
Absolutely. I think the experience of having live plants in the museum really brings it to life. There's so many stereotypes related to something that's literally just a weed and a plant. And so for people to be able to learn more about the scientific background on it, understand that it's only one ingredient, THC, that's creating the psychoactive effect, that has so many other uses and values to it, is a great way for us to do more public education.
I know. I was thrilled that our county did that. I mean, you know, and we're everywhere. We cover 19 cities and counties on this. On this area, this radio show, and I really hope that they come to the museum. So there's a few things. We're coming to the end of the segment. Talk a little bit about, you know, it's okay for teens. What are your feelings about teenagers? Is it okay if they come and see the exhibit? Should parents come with them? I mean, what are some of the thoughts there? And then what do you hope people take away from the exhibit? What, when they walk out of there, what is your hope as a person who has put this together? What do you want them to walk away with?
Okay, absolutely. I think it's a great way to actually talk to teens. I've been a parent of two girls myself, and, you know, it's very hard to actually talk about drugs, but I think this is a really good point of entry. Bring your kids to the exhibit. Talk about drugs, not just marijuana, but all drugs. I think it's a really good point of entry to start talking about it.
I want to piggyback on that, because when you're honest about it, you have less problems. It's when you don't give the true facts and the kids want to experiment, then all of a sudden they say, hey, wait a minute, what they said is not true. So it's very important to be honest. You know, you wanted to say something to
them. I'm a fibromyalgia patient, so I've been using medical cannabis for over a decade, and I've been very discreet publicly about my use, because I don't want that to be something that's sensitive for my children. I brought my children to the museum exhibit, and because their parents, part of the industry, has been very hush-hush, I think this was a great opportunity for them to realize that this is something that is normal, that this is something that is, our law is changing, that we don't have to hide what our family's doing anymore, because we're coming into a regulated industry and doing things by the law. So as a parent who's been in the industry, my experience has been a little bit different. Yes, being honest and having these conversations has always a benefit, but for them, it's something that we don't have to hide anymore, because here it is being recognized in a formal setting.
And also, I love it, it's from prohibition to prescription, you know, that's showing that there's more than this, the mythology behind it, like this whole thing around reefer madness and all the other things, that propaganda that came out. Well, we're coming to the end of the segment, so let's talk about the museum again. When is it going to be on exhibit? What do you want people to walk away with? And any websites or anything that you'd like to share?
First of all, I suggest you check our website, www.museumsc.org. That will give you details of the exhibit. It'll also give you our hours, and it'll give you programs. But just to let you know that our museum is open Tuesday through Sunday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. And it does have admission. It's a relatively inexpensive admission. And please do come and check it out. The takeaway that I want you to have is actually, hopefully it'll open up all your preconceptions that you might have had. And we are trying to deal with facts rather than emotional content here. So we hope that everybody actually comes and reads everything and gets that out of it. And also, as I said, I hope you'll actually notice how interesting and I mentioned this before, that legislation actually often comes about with emotional responses. And that hopefully will make you maybe a better voter in recognizing how some of these bills come through and how some of these laws come about.
Well, Cynthia, I want to thank you very much. And, you know, just to remind our listeners, all the information that we have given on the air is on Women's Spaces, www.womenspaces.com, The Times, and all the other good things that are happening. And I want to thank Cynthia. Cynthia's wonderful. She gave Ken and I a tour. I mean, she's just fabulous. And one of the things that Cynthia does, and I wrote about this in the Sonoma County snippets, Sonoma Gazette snippets that I write, is one of the things that Cynthia always does. She always gives you a little tidbit of information that nobody would ever know. So what we found out on the tour was La Cucaracha, the song La Cucaracha, there is actually a verse dedicated to marijuana. And if folks want to know, I'm going to put it on our website. I didn't put it, but that actually that song, part of it was singing for marijuana. Well, Cynthia Long from the Museum of Sonoma County, thank you so much for being here. And Sarah Schrader, the director of Americans for Safe Access, the Sonoma County chapter, thank you both for being here. And thank you, Cynthia, for really putting that beautiful, helping to put that beautiful exhibit together. And for you, Sarah, for all the work you've done. Wow. What an interview. It's so interesting. And what I'm going to do now, I'm going to dedicate a special song. And this is all about the past with marijuana. It's called Who's the Pusher Now by Ellen Booksdale. You're going to love this song. I mean, it's one of my favorite songs. I remember when I first heard it, really does talk about the prohibition and some of the issues that we've gone through. And when we come back, I'm going to be talking with Shelley Browning, and we're going to be talking about public banking, which I think is very important, because when you look at the marijuana movement, they don't know where to put their money. I mean, it's amazing. Here we got all this taxes going, and they don't know what bank we're going to put it into. So this is a perfect marriage. So let's go ahead and listen to Who's the Pusher Now? And like I said, when we come back, we will be talking about public banking. So don't leave us.
Background 1935, Depression. Riding high, people trying to have some fun, smoking dope and opium. Government did what they do best, making a mess, made a crime that's victimless, criminalizing cannabis. And the big drug money machine sells oxy and morphine. Legal drugs get us hooked, a million deaths. Who's the pusher now? Follow the corporate money trail while decent people rot in jail. Guarantee full occupancy for private prison industry. Caught up in a living hell with a couple of million prison cells and government hypocrisy. Now, the war on drugs, a political joke, locking us up for smoking dope. No reason for doing time with a punishment when there ain't no crime. Cartels are running beer. Prohibition made it clear. When you turn a market black, it's hard to turn it back. The government gets behind the gun. The IRS has never done our taxes pay. The FDA, so the DEA can put us away. In the government drug money machine runs like it's on Dexedrine. Politicians legislate so they can mass incarcerate. Who's the pusher now? And the big drug money machine
on wars made us all crazy. That's one of my favorite songs. Listen, I have a special announcement to make. There's going to be a special book talk at the Museum of Sonoma County on cannabis. It's called The Dark Day, Dark Night, A Marijuana Murder Mystery. And the discussion is going to be held with Johanna Ruskin is the one who wrote the book, and he's going to be talking and discussing this with a woman by the name of Elizabeth Tooth. And it's going to be at the museum, and the museum is located at 425 7th Street in Santa Rosa. It's going to be happening on June 26th at 7 o'clock. So, you know, like I said, everything that we have talked about is going to be on Women's Spaces, www.womenspaces.com. Well, welcome back. You are listening to Women's Spaces, and I am your host, Elaine B. Holt. And without further ado, I want to introduce my next guest. Joining me in the studio is Shelley Browning from Friends of Public Banking. And welcome, Shelley. Welcome to Women's Spaces.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, before we start, I would like to tell our listeners just a little bit about you. And I'm really excited about this particular topic. I had a woman by the name of Laura Wells on several times who talked about it. And she ran, I think, for controller in San Francisco. And it's a very, very interesting and a very timely issue to be talking about. Well, Shelley Browning is the owner and operator of a local sign language interpreting agency. She holds a BA in cultural anthropology and an MA in English as a second language. She has been actively involved in the public banking movement for the past 7 years. She actually helped to establish the Friends of Public Banking in Santa Rosa and is actively involved with the statewide California Public Banking Alliance, which is a coalition of public banking activists in cities from San Diego to Eureka, working collectively to create socially and environmentally responsible city and regional public banks. Well, welcome. That's a mouthful.
I know, it's exciting.
A lot of energy. Well, Shelley, let's start the interview. How did you get involved, and what was your motivation? I mean, what all of a sudden you woke up one day and said, this is what I have to do, and this is what has to happen in our country?
Thank you. Well, there's really two key things that led me to this personally. As the owner of a sign language interpreting agency back in 2009, I was contracting with several different state departments, and I was paid by the state with an IOU on one of my contracts after the 08 collapse. The state didn't have the money to pay the small business owners that they were subcontracting with. And then also I served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Tunisia back in from 88 to 1990. I taught a little deaf school in the Sahara Desert, and as you guys are probably well aware, the Arab Spring began in the country of Tunisia. So when the Occupy movement came, it was really sparked by that to the United States. When the Occupy movement began in New York, there was a day where they asked cities and towns across the country to join in solidarity with what was happening in New York. And it came to the streets of Santa Rosa, and I came into the march for those two reasons, because it was my people back in Tunisia that began this revolution, and because I experienced not being paid by the state. And so I knew that things were not right economically if a state couldn't pay its workers.
You had personal, you know, I watched a series of the Buddha. It was 55 episodes. And one of the things he said over and over, you learn best by your own experience. And you had that experience, which kind of sparked you. Well, so what was your next steps? I mean, what were the next steps?
I joined in the Occupy movement. I kept showing up for a lot of different things. And I, got to meet Mark Armstrong, who is the co-founder of the Public Banking Institute. He co-founded that with Ellen Brown, who wrote the Public Banking Solution and is really the, you know, sort of the godmother of the public banking movement. And I just kept showing up to everything that and listening to everything Mark had to say. And, you know, it seems like the single best issue for me to keep my focus on is to follow the money. You know, I became more aware of the corrupt practices of the Wall Street banks through the Occupy movement when we all started to become aware of the foreclosure crisis that was happening across the country. And it's still having profound effects on our community today. The number of homeless people has been dramatically ramped up. And, you know, we're a cross-section of America. This is happening all across America. And so is the public banking movement. We're, you know, there's there's towns and cities and states all across the country that are working on this right now as a way to, you know, recapture our public dollars that are currently being banked and deposited and invested in Wall Street banks, and trying to find a way that perhaps we could create our own bank to deposit our own dollars into to serve the needs of our community.
Well, talk a little bit about North Dakota, you know, to give an example, because North Dakota already has they've had public banking for eons.
Right. Just celebrated their 100-year anniversary. Oh, they were established in 1919, and in February they had their one-year anniversary, and the bank served cake to celebrate. I would have loved to have been there. But, you know, that came about by farmers. Farmers were the ones who really fought to bring the bank forward, because they didn't have a lot of control of, you know, their grains were being, there were no silos to store their grains in North Dakota. They were being brought by train to Minnesota, and, you know, the railroads were charging exorbitant fees to transfer their grains. The silos were charging exorbitant fees to store their grains. The banks were charging exorbitant fees on their loans for farms and farming needs, their equipment. And so they were, you know, they were the pioneers and the revolutionaries that sought control of their own economic destiny. And they knew that, you know, if they had a bank, that bank could lend to their needs. So North Dakota started this bank in 1919. And one of the first things the bank did was build a silo and storage place for their grains to be processed and stored. And that is still in operation today, as well as the bank.
Well, it's an amazing story. And they also survived all the economic crisis. They seem to be moving along because they have this economic system. Well, you know,
that's right. After the 08 collapse, let me just say that North Dakota was the only state in the country to escape that collapse. And, you know, the head of the bank, he said, well, part of the reason we survived is we never invested in derivatives because we didn't know what they were. The state has the lowest unemployment rate, the lowest default rate, and the largest percentage of local banks and credit unions than any state in the nation. And that's because the state of North Dakota's mission statement says we will partner with our local banks and credit unions to enhance our local communities.
Amazing, amazing. Well, let's get into California now. Let's talk a little bit about AB 857. You know, what is that bill? Can you give a little bit of the intel? And I know there's about 12 cities. In fact, one of our cities, the city of Santa Rosa, just did a resolution that I just read to support this bill. What does that mean to us? And talk a little bit about the bill, what it enhances.
Well, so that bill was, first of all, sponsored by the California Public Banking Alliance, which you mentioned in the bio there, that it's comprised of activists up and down the state, from San Diego to Eureka, who, just like us, the activists here in Santa Rosa, had established working groups to look at public banking in our areas. And we coalesced and we formed this statewide alliance. And collectively, we sponsored the Public Banking Act bill. It's AB 857. It was authored by Santiago and Chu, and it has passed through the Assembly. It passed through the first Senate Governance and Finance, last week it passed the Senate Banking and Financial Institutions Committee, and on July 3rd it will go to the Senate Governance and Finance Committee. So we've been working to get towns and cities to endorse it. So far, 12 have. Santa Rosa was the 12th one just last week at their city council meeting to unanimously vote to endorse this bill, as well as 150 organizations up and down the state, including the California Democratic Party, the Nurses Association. Many organizations have endorsed.
Well, you know, it was very interesting because I'm not able to go to city council meetings often, and so what I will do is watch the film.
Yeah.
And one of the concerns that I was listening to was when John Sawyer spoke, you know, and I thought that was very, very interesting, that some of the issues that he had. And so what is some of the...
Well, his concern, there was a resolution, and his point was well taken, that, you know, there were some things stated in the resolution that had to do with, you know, I don't recall it all offhand. I mean, I helped to author that resolution, so I had no objection with his concerns. He just felt like it stated things that they may or not necessarily be in agreement with at the city council, but they definitely supported the idea of AB 857. And briefly, you know, AB 857 is, we're asking the Office of Business Oversight within the state to issue a brand new license or charter for a public bank. So that if a town or city or county or a JPA wanted to start their own public bank, there would now be a licensure to do so. If this doesn't pass, they could still, public banks could still be established. But the reason why we want this licensure is we want some mandates to be stated within that they would, whenever possibly, be required to partner with local banks and credit unions to extend credit into the local communities. That there could be some mandates that there are social and environmental responsible banking requirements. Like, for example, you can't invest in these monies in the fossil fuel industry, the private prison industry, the military industrial complex. I mean, we could have a say, but when we put our money on deposit in the Wall Street banks, we have no say and we have no idea and no transparency of where that money is going to. They're mandated to serve their shareholders, whereas public banks are mandated to serve the stakeholders of the community whose money that is they have invested.
It's a big difference when you think of who's getting the money, who's utilizing the money, and where it's going.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden as you were talking, and I was realizing, you know, like there's billions that is going into the wars, you know, and oftentimes the money comes out of some of the banks that we put deposits in, some of the interest and some of the things they pay. So it's really something to look at a little bit closely. I know for myself, I'm a little bit ignorant on it. This is really, you're really educating me from the moment that I listened to you, and it, going and reading about AB 857 was just amazing to me. And reading that resolution, congratulations. I mean, I was on the Human Rights Commission. I know about resolutions, and that was an excellent, excellent resolution. And also, I want folks to know that I did write an article in the Sonoma County Gazette about what Shelley is talking about. And also, what can people do? I mean, here, AB 857 is going to the legislation. Should people be calling? What should they do?
Yeah, absolutely. On July 3rd, as I said, it will go to the next Senate committee, and that's the Senate's Senate Governance and Finance Committee that's headed up. The chair is Senator Mike McGuire, who's our local senator. So everybody should be giving him a call and asking for his yes vote on this bill when it comes before him and his committee. And then if you're with specific organizations, we want to have as many organizations endorse this as possible. And the best way to get to the endorsement form is just to go to the California Public Banking Alliance.org website, and you'll find the endorsement form there, and you can see who else has endorsed as well.
Let me ask you something, Shelley. You know, now that you've been in this and you've been exploring all the different things, do you think it's something that we need more of an immediate push, or is this something that we can just kind of hang out and wait to have happen?
We need an immediate push, and have a friend from West Africa that says they have a saying in Burkina Faso that you have to fight constantly and permanently. You know, we have to keep pushing this. We're up against the Wall Street banks. And I would just like to take a minute to say where the city of Santa Rosa currently banks are and invests our money. And please understand, I'm talking about sales tax revenue. The largest source of income for the city of Santa Rosa is sales tax. Second is property tax. So every time you buy a bottle of water or a grocery, anytime you are spending money locally, that is generating sales tax revenue that goes to the city of Santa Rosa. They take that money and they bank it. Currently at Chase Bank. Formerly, they were 15 years at Wells Fargo. And, you know, that money gets deposited there, and it's used for things like payroll to the city employees. It covers the cost of fire, you know, paying the fighters and police officers. And so that it was banked at Wells Fargo for 15 years. And in 2017, the Department of Justice downgraded Wells Fargo to a needs improvement status. And the reason why it was under the Community Reinvestment Act, nationwide, Wells Fargo was not investing enough of the dollars back into the local communities that they had, you know, banked within their banks. And predominantly that was in small business loans. You know, they weren't lending to small businesses in local communities. And so our former CFO said that there's a state law, that was Debbie Lochner, was in the Press Democrat, says there's a state law that says a city cannot bank with a bank that needs improvement. So has that status. So they put out a bid, an RFP for a new bank. And this past January, they ended up signing a 5-year contract with JP Morgan Chase. So that is where we currently bank. And I would just like to say that Chase is the largest investor in the world in the fossil fuel industry. The past year alone, based on the 2019 fossil fuel report card, JP Morgan Chase has invested in the last 3 years $1.9 trillion in the fossil fuel industry, up 68% from last year. They are ramping up. We've invested there. We bank there. We are helping to finance the fossil fuel industry, and I'm trying to help the city understand we cannot continue to put our money there. And when our towns and cities are impacted by climate change through fires and floods, that we fix that situation by further taxing the taxpayers with tax measures and bond measures. It'll never balance out.
Wow, that is amazing. That is amazing. It really is when you tell. And folks have got to get involved. So like I said, you go on Women's Spaces, you'll find all the phone numbers, who you contact. And Mike McGuire is very open to hearing from people. Well, Shelley Browning, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. Give the website one more time. We're at the end of our segment.
Thank you. It's the California Public Banking Alliance.
Alliance.org. Well, thank you. Oh, what a show. So much information. I mean, public banking, cannabis, all the different things, and all I can think of, the times are changing, and they're changing for the better. You know, all of a sudden you start thinking, what's going on? Is anything positive happening? All you have to do is listen to these two different segments, and you feel like the world is moving. It's not just holding still. Well, that's it for our show. A special thank you to Cynthia Long, the Visitor Services and Volunteer Coordinator and Chair for the Museum of Sonoma County, and to Sarah Schrader, who is the Chair of American for Safe Access, and, of course, Shelley Browning, who is from Friends of Public Banking. You know, amazing when you start thinking about it. I mean, I was really shocked when I think of all the money, trillions they're talking about, going into the fossil fuel industry. I mean, we're wasting our money. We're wasting our earth by doing all these things. Hey, listen, a reminder. Tell your friends. Women's Spaces will be aired again tonight at 11 p.m. on KBBS 89.1 FM. I'm available for speaking engagements. And if you have any announcements, please email me at elaine@womenspaces.com. And remember, the children are our future, and we must never lose sight of that.
The woman in your life, the woman in your life is you.
The previous Women's Spaces show was recorded on Monday, June 24th, 2019.